On your radio dub, it's Ralph Schumann and Maya Schoen. If I take a name, so forget the rest. Take a name is the best. They got it all from live shows to hidden reality on DVDs. So stay tuned and listen up. Matter of fact, turn your dials up, cause you're now listening to Take a Name with Ralph Schumann and Maya Schoen. Yeah.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Netanyahu at Bar-Ilan, affirming the Zionist project. No Palestinian presence in Eretz Yisrael. It was a long-awaited policy speech for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel. And it was in reaction to U.S. President Obama's speech in Cairo, specifically the portion in which he said, "For decades, there has been a stalemate. Two peoples with legitimate aspirations, each with a painful history that makes compromise elusive. The situation for the Palestinian people is intolerable, and America will not turn our backs on the legitimate Palestinian aspiration for dignity, opportunity, and a state of their own." In addition, President Obama went on to say that the issue of settlements was foremost and that settlement construction should stop. What was the reaction of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu? This is the second time he's been the Prime Minister of Israel, and he is a leader of the Likud party. Prime Minister Netanyahu has consistently said there should not be two states. What was his speech? Yossi Werte, a Haaretz correspondent, on June 15th said it was aimed solely for Obama's ears. As we would have said in Brooklyn, it was a fairy tale for the goyim. What do I mean? Let's look at the verbiage of Netanyahu, a speech he gave at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies at Bar-Ilan University in Tel Aviv. He began with a lie. "Peace has always been our people's ardent desire." He went on to say, "I share the president's desire to bring about a new era of reconciliation in our region. To this end, I met with President Mubarak in Egypt and King Abdullah in Jordan to elicit the support of these leaders in expanding the circle of peace in our region. I turn to all Arab leaders tonight and I say, let us meet. Let us speak of peace and let us make peace. I am ready to meet with you at any time. I am willing to go to Damascus, to Riyadh, to Beirut, to any place, including Jerusalem. I call on the Arab countries to cooperate with the Palestinians and with us to advance an economic peace. An economic peace is not a substitute for a political peace, but an important element in achieving it." He then says, "I turn to you, our Palestinian neighbors, led by the Palestinian Authority, and I say, quote, let us begin negotiations immediately without preconditions." Again, I reiterate, he says, immediately without preconditions. "We want to live with you in peace as good neighbors. No one in Israel wants war. No preconditions?" The entire speech is a list of preconditions. Preconditions which state explicitly the Zionist project, no Palestinian presence in Eretz Yisrael. Let's look at the preconditions set by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. 1. A fundamental prerequisite for ending the conflict is a public, binding, and unequivocal Palestinian recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. To vest this declaration with practical meaning, there must also be a clear understanding that the Palestinian refugee problem will be resolved outside Israel's borders. For it is clear that any demand for resettling Palestinian refugees within Israel undermines Israel's continued existence as the state of the Jewish people. First, let me say that any connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel has lasted for more than 3,500 years. Judea and Samaria, the places where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, David and Solomon, and Isaiah and Jeremiah lived, are not alien to us. This is the land of our forefathers. The right of the Jewish people to a state in the land of Israel does not derive from the catastrophes that have plagued our people. The tragic history of powerlessness explains why the Jewish people need a sovereign power of self-defense. But our right to build our sovereign state here in the land of Israel arises from one simple fact. This is the homeland of the Jewish people. This is where our identity was forged. The preconditions go on. Within this homeland, there lives a large Palestinian community. We do not want to rule over them. We do not want to govern their lives. We do not want to impose either our flag or our culture on them. What does he want? He says clearly again. I have already stressed the first principle, recognition. Palestinians must clearly and unambiguously recognize Israel as the state of the Jewish people. The second principle, he goes on to elaborate, demilitarization. The territory under Palestinian control must be demilitarized with ironclad security provisions for Israel. In order to achieve peace, we must ensure that the Palestinians will not be able to import missiles into their territory to field an army, to close their airspace to us, or to make pacts with the likes of Hezbollah and Iran. He elaborates further. The Palestinians will be demilitarized, namely without an army, without control of its airspace, and with effective security measures to prevent weapons smuggling into the territory. Real monitoring and not what occurs in Gaza today. Israel needs defensible borders, Netanyahu says, and Jerusalem must remain the united capital of Israel. About the settlements. We have no intention of building new settlements or expropriating additional land for existing settlement. But there is a need to enable the residents to live normal lives, to allow mothers and fathers to raise their children like families elsewhere. The settlers, he says, are neither the enemies of the people nor the enemies of peace. Rather, they are an integral part of our people, a principled, pioneering, and Zionist public. This is the speech of Benjamin Netanyahu. As we said in our title, affirming the Zionist project, no Palestinian presence in Eretz Yisrael. And that is the entire historical land of Israel. Ralph?
Well, I think it's important, Maya, as we look at what Netanyahu set forth here, and this was, by the way, a declaration to the United States, as well as it was to the Palestinian bourgeoisie, that the terms of engagement with the Zionist state require the removal of the Palestinians from Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. Over and over again, he sets out the thesis, which is the continued theme of every major Zionist spokesperson over the entire course of the Zionist movement, i.e., that the Palestinian people have no right to exist, as Rafi Eitan, the chief of staff, had stated, on even one centimeter of Eretz Israel. In our book, Homage to Palestine, that Maya and I published in 1991, there is a citation, quote, "It is time to rip away the veil of hypocrisy. In the present as in the past, there is no Zionism, no settlement of our land, no Jewish state without the removal of all the Arabs, without confiscation." This was stated by Yibane Poret for the Israeli Ministry of Defense in 1982. But it is but the reiteration of a theme that has been sounded, as I state, by every spokesperson for the Zionist movement from its nominal right to its nominal left. And I want to take a brief moment, Maya, to place Benjamin Netanyahu in the appropriate context in which he belongs. Because Benjamin Netanyahu is a person who, in fact, was raised in the United States, and indeed Not only was he raised in the United States, but he functioned as an operative of the Central Intelligence Agency for a sustained period of time. And as was exposed by Nevi Gordon and by other Israeli journalists and in the Jerusalem Post and elsewhere, Netanyahu had four identities in the United States. He went under the name of John J. Sullivan, John J. Sullivan Jr., Benjamin Netai, and Benjamin Netanyahu. And he had both passports and identities that corresponded to these various personae. This is a functionary who is integral with the reinforcement arm of imperialism, as he has been a basic hitman for the program of Zionist removal of the Palestinian population from their land and from history. I reiterate, as you have mentioned in this speech that he gave, which was essentially a statement to American imperialism as to what are the terms of engagement when one talks about a peace process, which he makes clear is a process of pacification. The critical issue, he says, unless we have a situation in which the Palestinian entity is without army, without control of airspace, without effective measures to prevent materials coming in, the Palestinians cannot make treaties or military treaties, because without that we will have another Hamastan. We will never agree to this. Israel will govern its own fate and security. We will get a guarantee of demilitarization. Well, let's look at what the concrete meaning of this, Maya, in Gaza for the moment. Any materials that pertain to the reconstruction of the devastated Gaza, which means concrete, which means aluminum, which means steel, which means elementary equipment to rebuild houses, has been rejected and barred by the Israelis on the ground that would service the bringing in of the materials from which homemade rockets can be constructed.
Ralph, that would include fertilizer, too.
Virtually anything, and that goes to foodstuffs, that goes to elementary supplies for sewage disposal.
Let's go to the reactions to the Netanyahu speech. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs said last Monday, quote, "I think the Netanyahu government took a big step forward yesterday in acknowledging for the first time the need for a two-state solution. I think the president believes that there's a long way to go and many twists and turns in the road to go there, but is pleased thus far with the progress that's being made. And I think yesterday's speech certainly is a big part of that." We should note that the word state, the two states, was used just once in the Netanyahu speech, but over and again he mentioned the Zionist project. As Yossi Verda, the Haaretz correspondent, said, Netanyahu's speech aimed solely for Obama's ears in his analysis. He called the speech, quote, "an ocean of right-wing rhetoric full of national symbols." He said the two words, Palestinian state, which were followed by the third, demilitarized, that these two words were uttered like a rotten tooth pulled from its socket without anesthesia. And Verda went on to also say that five prime ministers said it before Netanyahu, two of them from the Likud. So yesterday's drama at Bar-Ilan University was quite limited, quite limited. He might say the words peace. He might say two-state as accommodation, but in effect, what Benjamin Netanyahu states over and again in clear language, there is no room for the Palestinians in the historic Eretz Yisrael.
Well, he extends that, as you mentioned, Maya, to Judea and Samaria, which he says is the land of our ancestors, where Abraham and David and so on walked. This is indeed an articulation of the claim to Eretz Yisrael as set forth in 1947 by Rabbi Fishman when he presented a formal map to the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, when the Jewish Agency was advancing its proposition as to what constituted Eretz Israel, or the land of Israel.
Well, it went further than Judea and Samaria, Ralph. It goes to...
They produced a map, as we've often discussed on Taking Aim, based upon the second volume of Theodor Herzl's historic work on the Zionist project. And the map, I believe it's on page 731 of volume 2, sets forth unmistakably and clearly what do these people, and that includes Benjamin Netanyahu, what do they mean by Eretz Yisrael, or the land of Israel? All of Palestine, all of Cisjordan, all of Lebanon, two-thirds of Iraq, one-half of Syria, the southern tier of Turkey, one-third of Arabia, Egypt, up to the Nile, including Cairo, indeed, even Kuwait. There is a very...
Lebanon, up to the Litani.
No, not all of Lebanon, Maya.
Ah.
The map includes all of Lebanon, as I mentioned, half of Syria, two-thirds of Iraq, southern tier of Turkey, Cisjordan. I mean, it is indeed a region which is considered by the Zionists from their inception to be the project. And every spokesperson has articulated the view that these questions of what constitutes the land are on a timetable. And the Palestinians are usurpers. They have no historic relation to this land. They are simply a remnant, opportunist, nomadic, tribal presence who have intruded themselves upon Eretz Israel. And what's extraordinary about this, of course, is that Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu is descended from people who have no relation to Palestine, historic or other, because Ashkenazim or European Jews, such as Mr. Netanyahu or ourselves for that matter, are in fact descendants of the Khazars, a 8th and 9th century empire that converted to Judaism at the time, from which European Jews are descended. Indeed, as I've often discussed, if one wanted any, as it were, scientific data which demonstrates the ethnic origins of European Jewry, for what the hell it matters, apropos the question of Palestine, but here's the point. European Jews are susceptible to a genetic condition known as Tay-Sachs disease, analogous to what African Americans suffer with
sickle cell anemia.
What's interesting about this is that only European Jews are susceptible to this genetic trait. No Semitic people is. That means none of the Jews from the Arab East, the Mizrahim.
From Yemen or from Iraq.
Yemen or Iraq or North Africa or any of the areas of the region. Because like their Arab brothers and sisters, who are, as are the Arab Jews.
The Palestinians would be converts to Islam.
Well, the point is very ironic. As we've often made it, and I think we should take just this brief moment to emphasize this. Who do you think was converted to the proselytizing and dynamic Islamic religion in the 6th century? The indigenous inhabitants. They were Jews. They were non-believers. They were Zoroastrians. They were people of various local religious and other views, animist views. The irony of all this is that the Palestinian people have a greater genetic link to the Jews of the region by descent than the Ashkenazim, who have no relation to this region whatsoever. So this is essentially a racist and pseudoscientific attempt historically to lay claim to an area and to translate their god into a real estate agent. This belongs to you, and this belongs to you, and da 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 da. There is no remote scintilla of evidence to establish a relationship between Jews in the world today and this region. None whatsoever, because the Jews of the period were expelled to Babylonia, and the remaining tribes were entirely assimilated to the populations of the area. And indeed, they are the antecedents of the Palestinian population. They have a greater relationship to the Hebrews of the early period than any Ashkenazim who is none whatsoever, by way of punctuating the irony and the point about the nature of a colonial settler project as an instrument of imperial conquest and nothing more.
Ralph, let's look at the reaction of the bourgeois press. And I start with The Guardian in England. Although the headline on June 14th, Sunday, by Rory McCarthy, writing from Jerusalem, is Netanyahu backs an independent Palestinian state for the first time. The prime minister insists on recognition of Israel. The actual content of the article shows, quote, his conditions were strict, And when they elaborate the key conditions, the Guardian makes clear that Benjamin Netanyahu, in his 30-minute speech using the phrase Palestinian state only once, insists that, quote, the Jewish people's link to the land of Israel stretching back, they say 2,000 years, but in fact he says in the speech 3,600 years, that this is first and foremost the intent of the speech. When we look at the Wall Street Journal and the article by Margaret Coker and Peter Spiegel on June 15th, they say, after their title of Israel Offers a Two-State Plan, that in fact, these are the words of Coker and Spiegel, it was a, quote, mixed message that he refuses to negotiate on core issues, and that is the biblical right to live in the territories.
Well, Maya, actually, The Guardian is very interesting on this whole question because The Guardian is quite summary, as you say. Netanyahu defends Israel's position that he offers few concessions. He praised the settlers who live in East Jerusalem and on the occupied West Bank. He refused U.S. calls to halt settlement growth. And what did he say? He said there has to be a natural growth. What do you mean by natural growth? That the settlements, which now are, in fact, occupying something like 80% in practical terms of the West Bank, which is in itself the West Bank, but 22%. Of historic Palestine. So in essence, 20% of 22%, which is something like 4% of Palestine, is what we're talking about here. And in that remnant 4%, what are they doing? We wrote a series of articles in 1988 and 1991 that we cited in last week's program, indicating clearly that the project had been to prepare for 800,000 Israeli settlers or colonists in the West Bank by the year 2010. Roughly now there are about 600,000. They say 500,000. In fact, it's really about 600,000.
Including all of Jerusalem.
And what that means in practical terms when he talks about natural growth is that the existing settlements, which are all over the West Bank, effectively occupying 80% of it, will expand. Well, they're only little slivers of Palestinian territory in between these settlements, and they are governed by military checkpoints and military roads and by a virtual concentration camp of control, which Netanyahu is at pains to emphasize must be intensified. There must be demilitarization. There must be total Israeli control over any commerce, over any treaties, over any relations, whether economic or political, with outside parties. As the Guardian points out, he praised the settlers who live in East Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank. He refuses to call for a halt of settlement growth. He states that the Palestinian refugees who were forced out or fled from their homes will not be allowed to return to what is Israel, he said, and that Jerusalem will remain united under Israeli control. Jerusalem, by the way, under the settlement program, is everything between Hebron and Bethlehem. Jerusalem is not just East and West Jerusalem. It has now been expanded to engulf virtually a whole sector of the West Bank, the heartland of the West Bank, the central means through which transport and communications are governed, controlled, and policed. And then he states, if we receive guarantees, the Guardian cites, regarding demilitarization and the protection of Israel's security needs, that's an open sesame. What is the determination of the security needs? The Zionist state. They will monitor every time they break wind in Palestine as to how it impacts, quote, their security needs. The Palestinians will recognize Israel as the state of the Jewish people. This is a call for expulsion. The 20% of the Palestinians who live within Eretz Israel are in the state of the Jewish people.
No, you mean the 20% of the population of Israel are Israeli Arabs.
Yes, I mean the Palestinian population within the Green Line, the remnant of those who were not expelled, the 700,000 who were driven out in 47 and 48, and the remnant who remained, who are now approximately a million people in number, will not be allowed to remain. It is very explicit here. What Netanyahu is talking about is absorbing the settlement territories of the West Bank and transferring the Palestinians who remain inside the Green Line to this concocted entity that is policed by the Zionist stormtroopers. Here's the Guardian. The conditions are strict. Palestinians cannot form an army or control their airspace or sign agreements with a state. There will be areas of Palestinian control where they will be allowed to have a flag and an anthem. A flag and an anthem. Thank you very much. The protocol here is as follows. Netanyahu stated that the settlers, the colonists in West Bank, will be allowed to continue their normal lives. And the Guardian states, this is taken to mean that they will continue to accommodate the growth of these settlements. It will be called natural growth. It cannot be frozen, as was called for under the U.S. roadmap plan of 2003. Israeli withdrawals from land they had occupied will be no longer honored. Settlers, quote, is what Netanyahu states, settlers are neither enemies of the people nor of peace. They are our brothers and our sisters. They are Zionists. They have values. They will be protected and they will not be restrained. The simple truth, he states, is the root of this conflict has been and still is the refusal to accept the right of the Jewish people to have their state of their own in their land. The refugee problem will find its solution outside the borders of Israel over and again. And the Guardian is very clear in specifying that the gravamen of this speech is a declaration, formally and finally, that the project of Zionism is expansion, removal, subjugation, and, in fact, essentially, the removal of the Palestinian people, not merely from their land, but from history.
Ralph, the Hebrew term for Israeli settlements outside the Green Line means, quote, evoking biblical injunctions and promises to inherit the land through settlement. This is very important to understand when he talks about the settlers as being pioneers. In Arabic, the term that's used to refer to settlements translates literally as colonies. I was thinking when preparing this show, I hearkened back to the removal of the Native Americans, the American Indians, by the colonists and the expansion of the U.S. colonial imperialism across the land that is now the United States. And the false treaties, and as soon as there was a concession, then the government would defy the concession and push even further, so that you have a remnant of the Native American population in reservations.
Well, Maya, this is very clearly seen in the way he constructs his speech. Netanyahu speaks about the settlers, the colonists, as pioneers. Now, he doesn't use that language lightly. When you refer to them as pioneers, he's summoning up the history of the United States. The people who expropriated the Native Americans, the people whose presence in the land of the West in the United States was the predicate for the campaigns of extermination of the Native Americans, the people whose usurpation of the land in the United States resulted in the confining of Native Americans to reservations are the model to which Netanyahu refers explicitly in this speech. The very framework with which this is constructed placed the Palestinians in the position of being in remnant areas surrounded by security forces and Israeli populations without any entitlement to make treaties or have sovereignty by any virtual understanding, any meaningful understanding of that term. This is the program for the removal of the Palestinian people to what can be called only detention camp reservations as cheap labor, and where they can make what? They can make beads, they can make turquoise bags, they can be tourist attractions, they can be virtually like other species in a zoo.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Shunman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Netanyahu at Bar-Ilan, affirming the Zionist project, no Palestinian presence in Eretz Yisrael. Ralph, I'd like to restart our program with reference to the actual statistics of settlement growth, that is, the growth of the settlers within the historic occupied territories. The West Bank, including East Jerusalem. In 1948, there were 480 Jews, and they lived among four communities that had been established between 1927 and 1947, notably Gush Etzion. 1972, the numbers rose. This is after the 1967 Six-Day War and the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, the Sinai, and the Golan Heights. 1,182. Expansion continued. And in 1983, this is after the invasion of Lebanon, 22,800. With the government of Yitzhak Shamir, Ariel Sharon had been defense minister, the primary person responsible for the massacre at Sabra and Shatila. Ariel Sharon was made the housing minister, and Ariel Sharon had developed a plan, the Star Plan, for the settlement of the West Bank, Judea, Samaria. In 1993, the settlement growth, primarily with immigrants from Eastern Europe and immigrants from throughout the Arab East, 111,600, rising through the Labor and Likud governments to 2004, 234,487, and in 2006, almost 300,000 people. East Jerusalem, in 1948, 2,300 people, and today, over 184,057. So this comes to almost 500,000 people if you also include the Golan Heights. Aside from this settlement is the occupation of further areas of East Jerusalem, which have been estimated by various Israeli organizations to add up to 650,000 Jews in the occupied territories. Ralph.
Maya, there's an article by Michelle Goldberg called Netanyahu's Illusory Concessions on Palestine. And she said, when Israeli TV after the speech went to talk to the settlers, they were all happy, said M.J. Rosenberg, director of policy analysis of the Israeli Policy Forum, a think tank that advocates for a two-state solution. Now, what's instructive about that is that the article cites the Los Angeles Times calling Netanyahu's announcement as a concession to the Obama administration, and then the Wall Street Journal is cited to the effect that this is no doubt, as the speechwriters of Netanyahu intended it, a verbal concession to the name, the formula of two states, while emptying the concession of any meaning whatsoever. Because as this article by Goldberg states, that Israel is a Jewish state means that Palestinians do not form any part of it. They represent one-fifth of the Israeli population within the Green Line. What this means in essence is that these people will no longer remain. No one is failing to understand the underlying dynamic of this speech. In keeping with the Likud line that there is no such thing as a Palestinian people, she writes, Netanyahu asserts the historic Jewish claim to Judea and Samaria and described the Palestinians as, quote, living in the very heart of our homeland.
Ralph, the Wall Street Journal, in the article that I was referring to by Margaret Coker and Peter Spiegel, again notes what you're saying. Mr. Netanyahu, they write, historically has refused to negotiate these core issues, and he repeated the stance in Sunday's address. Instead, he rejected the idea that settlers were a hurdle to a two-state solution and said they had a big biblical right to live in the territory. We should also note that the head of the Kadima party, Tzvi Livni, had come out and said that the Palestinians, the Israeli Arabs, within the pre-67 Israel that should there be two states, they should move. That was one of her main positions, that there was no room for them in a Jewish state.
Well, Maya, in the National, a publication in Abu Dhabi, the associate editor, Craig Nelson, under the headline, Niggling, Begrudging, and Cowardly, writes the following. This is the man who said Yasser Arafat, quote, was worse than Hitler. This is the man who proposed that revolvers must be distributed to all adult Jewish males as the solution to the terror problem. Mr. Netanyahu has not tempered his inclination for demagogy, he writes. It is the old Bibi, dancing around the issue of talks by saying he's prepared for direct negotiations without preconditions, and then proceeding to enumerate the conditions which make the negotiations pointless. It will not be surprising for us to wake up tomorrow to find Israeli bulldozers building roads in the West Bank so the settler families can live normal lives. Mr. Netanyahu demanded Palestinians' acceptance of the Jewish state while referencing his own political party, the platform of which calls for, quote, a greater Israel between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River, quote unquote.
Ralph, what Bibi did in this speech is he put the onus on the Palestinians. Instead of it being the Zionist project, the problem is that the Palestinians reject Eretz Yisrael is the Jewish homeland. And as the Washington Post noted, even though its article says Netanyahu backs two-state goal, the Washington Post, in its article of June 15th by Howard Schneider, notes that Netanyahu shifted the discussion to what he views as the core issue, that is longstanding Arab rejection of the idea of a Jewish national home in the land of our forefathers. So the Palestinians, instead of having a struggle for self-determination, instead of having the struggle to regain their homeland, it is the Palestinians who are the rejectionists.
Maya, as Rosa Luxemburg said so clearly, in the beginning was the deed. Here's an article by Jason Ditz on June 1st. United Nations, Israel's buffer zone keeps a third of Gaza's farmland unusable. Now we're talking about the buffer zone. Gazans who come within 300 meters of the border will be shot. The Israeli government dropped exploding boxes full of leaflets across the Gaza Strip, informing the Gazans. The leaflets damaged buildings and injured children. The real harm is yet to come. According to the United Nations, the 300-meter buffer has cut the Gazans off from 30% of the Gaza Strip's arable land. The war increased the amount of land destroyed. The farmers cannot plant anything because it is too dangerous, according to the United Nations officials. The Israeli soldiers shoot at everything. Dogs, sheep, children. They are very tense. Israel has shot Palestinian farmers for tending fields near the border fence. The regional government states that the strip is capable of producing enough watermelons and onions to satisfy domestic food demand. So as the Zionists are keeping foodstuffs and medical supplies and rebuilding equipment out of the devastated Gaza Strip, which they destroyed in a genocidal fashion, they have declared the border area verboten. And they are, in fact, shooting people, killing people, and effectively, as this report states, one-third of the Gaza farmland is now unusable. That is the predicate for what they mean by natural growth to settlements in the West Bank. There will be nothing left.
Ralph, let's look at what they've been doing in the West Bank. A Peace Now report from February 2009, new land seizure orders issued during the Gaza operation. That is, when all eyes were on Gaza, these were the moves made by the Zionists in Judea Samaria. A number of these orders were related to the route of the separation fence. Refencing between the Palestinian villages of Husan and Jabah and some of their lands. Construction of a fence along road number 375, 2 kilometers south of the village of Husan. Construction of this fence will separate the residents of Husan from parts of their land. On the same day, the Zionists seized land for the construction of an additional 400-meter fence west of the Palestinian village of Jaba, near the Green Line. Another seizure order, paving a security road between the settlements of Beitar Eilat and Givot. On January 1, 2009, the commander of the Judea and Samaria division signed a seizure order to pave a new road, 2.2 kilometers long, between these two settlements, running north to south. The order refers to a permanent road for the use of security forces. Construction of the patrol road in the heart of the Palestinian territories will be a real obstacle for Palestinian residents trying to reach their lands lying west of this road. The commanders of the Judea and Samaria divisions have been preventing Palestinians from reaching their farmland, have been surrounding them, making it impossible for villagers such as in Azum Atmi, which is surrounded by settlements of Elkana, Sharai Tikva, and the outpost of Magen Dan in the south and east, and another settlement, Oranit, in the west, and how there are fences all around this village separating them so that the villagers can't go in or out. They are stuck in their village and isolated. Ralph?
Zaid Nabulsi, April 19th, 2002. An article entitled, "Let's Talk About Terrorism, From Warsaw to Jenin." He is talking about the systematic destruction, desolation, of the refugee camp in the town, Palestinian town of Jenin.
In 2002.
Today, 19th of April, 2002, is the 59th anniversary of the outbreak of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising by the Jews in Nazi-occupied Poland. If I were to be a Jew today, I would be deeply ashamed of how history has repeated itself on the eve of this anniversary. The irony is simply too incredible to ignore, he writes. A totally isolated, starving civilian population, confined in a dreadful ghetto with endless curfews, an oppressed and wronged people with no hope of salvation, an expansionist enemy with an elected sadist at its head, who blames the subjugated victims for their miserable predicament, a desperate uprising that knows it has no chance of military victory, but a resistance movement that is determined to die fighting. A long, suffocating military siege, followed by a relentless and indiscriminate onslaught, a bloodbath, heroic martyrdom, a crushed uprising, the inevitable and unstoppable rebirth of a people. The shame that decent Jews feel today is compounded by the fact Israeli generals who are bent on crushing the will of the Palestinians today have themselves unremorsefully declared recently that, quote, "We must learn from the German tactics of suppressing the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in their current war against surrounded Palestinian ghettos. See the report of Amir Oren in Haaretz, January 25, 2002. And he writes, "The ghetto, and this is an excerpt from an underground Jewish resistance bulletin of April 29, 1943. The ghetto replied with armed struggle. The Jewish fighting organization opened a war of the weak against the strong, with scant forces, few arms, and little ammunition, without water. Blinded by smoke and fire, the Jewish fighters defended streets and individual houses. In the dusk, they withdrew step by step because of the fire that had taken hold in the close-built houses, because of the enemy equipped with modern military arms. They considered it a victory if part of those imprisoned were able to escape. It was a victory in their eyes to die while their hands still grasped arms." So while Israeli tanks and planes are wreaking destruction and death on the besieged ghettos of Palestine, while Israeli soldiers are destroying ambulances and preventing them from attending or burying the Palestinians who are left to bleed to death on the sides of roads and under the rubble of destroyed shacks and refugee camps, the usual suspects of pro-Israeli commentators are coming out yet again in blind defense of Israel, nauseatingly screaming "terrorists, terrorists" over and over again. And the article is supplemented by Yitzhak Laor in his article "After Jenin" in the London Review of Books. What has the war between us and the Palestinians been about? The Israeli attempt to slice what's left of Palestine into cantons, building separation roads, new settlements, and checkpoints. The rest is killing, terror, curfew, house demolitions, and propaganda. Palestinian children living in fear and despair, their parents humiliated in front of them, Palestinian society dismantled, public opinion in the West blaming it on the victims. The easiest way to face the horror. He writes, I know, because my father was a German Jew. And then he proceeds to elucidate what unfolded in Jenin. Maya?
And Ralph, I think it is important, and why we're addressing this today, to deal with the study by Israeli commanders of the techniques of the Nazis. Because many people have been criticized for calling the Zionist project the Judeo-Nazis. And essentially, this is a term that was first used in Israel itself.
Well, it was coined by Yoshe Shoah Leibovitz, who was the leading Jewish theologian who designated the Zionists as Judeo-Nazis based upon the program of genocide, the deliberate expulsion of the Palestinian people, the reduction to rubble of something like 90% of the towns and villages of Palestine.
Ralph, an important article was published in Haaretz at the time of the Zionist attack on Jenin, which was primarily an attack to put the last nail in the coffin of the PLO. And this was January 25th, 3 months before the IDF got the green light to invade the West Bank, surround Ramallah, attack Jenin. Amir Oren, a senior military commentator for Haaretz, quoted a senior officer, and here I am quoting the article. In order to prepare properly for the next campaign, one of the Israeli officers in the territory said not long ago that it is justified, and in fact essential to learn from every possible source. If the mission is to seize a densely populated refugee camp or to take over the Kasbah in Nablus, and if the commander's obligation is to try to execute the mission without casualties on either side, then he must first analyze and internalize the lessons of earlier battles. Even, however shocking it may sound, even how the German army fought in the Warsaw Ghetto. The officer indeed succeeded in shocking others, not least because he is not alone in taking this approach. Many of his comrades agree that in order to save Israelis now, it is right to make use of knowledge that originated in that terrible war, whose victims were their kin.
Now, it is important that Amir Oren's should expose the fact that the Nazi Wehrmacht plan for the Warsaw Ghetto was studied and used as a model for the assault by the Israeli armed forces on the Kasbah in Nablus, the old city, and in particular in Jenin. But it is nauseating to have ascribed to the Israeli commanders as to the Nazi Wehrmacht at the Warsaw Ghetto that the objective was to eliminate casualties or to remove casualties. What utter disgusting falsification of what that project was and what it remains. Here is Omar Barghouti, the byproduct, victims of the Holocaust, from Deir Yassin to Jenin. And he quotes the following. Between ourselves, it must be clear. There is no room for both peoples together in this country. We shall not achieve our goal of being an independent people with Arabs. The only solution is a Palestine without Arabs. There is no other way. We shall transfer them from here to neighboring countries, all of them. Not one village, not one tribe shall be left. There is no other way out. And Omar Barghouti is quoting the declaration by Yosef Weitz, the Zionist official in charge for Ben-Gurion of Jewish colonization, and of the member of the Jewish Agency's Transfer Committee, an ongoing committee, brothers and sisters, for the purpose of transferring, by massacre or whatever means, the population of Palestine outside expulsion. The same project that Netanyahu is intimating and outlining in this speech with respect to the Palestinian 20% remnant inside the Green Line. 54 years later, Barghouti writes, an Israeli soldier participating in the army's devastation and brutality in the Jenin refugee camp told The Guardian, the problem is there is no room in this small country for two peoples. It is a trial of strength. They want to throw us into the sea. We will do that to them. Unquote. The irony is that all those refugees in the Jenin camp were transferred from the coastal region of Haifa in 1948. They were the expulsion population from the coastal region of Haifa. They were transferred out after the destruction of their villages and towns and the surrounding area, quote, to make room for the influx of Jewish victims, unquote. Now they face death and destruction in another forced displacement, and indeed, as Baruti writes, the victims of the Holocaust are victimizing the byproduct victims of the Holocaust yet another time. The victims of the Holocaust would turn in their collective graves at the uses to which their experience and their suffering and their tragedy has been put by the Zionists who collaborated with the Nazis from the inception of the rise to power of Adolf Hitler, it should be added. But Baruti writes the following. The victims of one of history's worst crimes against humanity are increasingly resorting to the same tools of racist hatred and collective punishment to complete the job that the founders of Zionism envisioned, a pure Jewish state.
Ralph, I'd like to mention, as we end our program, the reaction of the Jordanians and the Egyptian and the Lebanese, because key to the Netanyahu speech was that the refugees, the over 4 million refugees, 1.5 million of whom are in refugee camps, that they could not return, that there would be no right of return. And so consequently, the Jordanians and the Lebanese in particular, where there are millions of refugees, they are looking closely at this speech. And in Jordan, the pro-government Al-Rai Daily ran an editorial titled, quote, Netanyahu offered rotten merchandise. Nobody will buy it. And Lebanese President Michael Sleiman described Netanyahu's speech as, quote, intransigent when it comes to dealing with peace or regarding the solution for Palestinian refugees. And in Saudi Arabia, the state-run Al Nadwa Daily said, quote, every paragraph of Netanyahu's speech makes us more pessimistic. And the Arab League Under Secretary General for Palestinian Affairs, Mohammed Sobeh, said the speech might satisfy, quote, extremists in Israel, but was, quote, too far from what peace needs. And in Egypt, President Mubarak himself, one who has been accommodating the Zionist state and the United States, Mubarak, in his comment, made his comments in a speech to Egyptian army commandos, and it was reported by the state-run MENA news agency, and it said the president said he had informed Netanyahu of his position prior to Netanyahu making the speech, and that the call for recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, quote, would only complicate matters. And the specific words, quote, you won't find anyone to answer that call in Egypt or in any other place. Ralph, to conclude.
Maya, I want to reference the following. We have been citing the article by Amir Orend in Haaretz, the article which was the first to disclose the fact that the Zionist military leadership made a careful study of the Wehrmacht plan for the destruction of the Warsaw Ghetto as the model for their campaigns in Nablus and particularly in Jenin. It's interesting to note, brothers and sisters, that on January 4th, 2009, 7 years later in Haaretz, Amir Oren has the following article with reference to the siege of Gaza. The IDF must move quickly to disengage in order to free its attention for the paramount task of preparing a military blow to Iran. As long as the great threat of Iranian power is hovering, the small threats of Hezbollah and Hamas that derive from it will not be dispelled. Amir Orent, brothers and sisters, from the Warsaw Ghetto to Jenin to Gaza and now on to Iran. And one final citation from Workers' World 59 years after the Nazis launched their final solution, attack on the Jewish population of the Warsaw Ghetto, the U.S. armed and financed Israeli defense forces, fighting under the banner of apartheid-like Zionism, have launched an attack on the Palestinian population of the city of Jenin. The Israeli commanders studied World War II-era Nazi military history well. The whole of the Palestinian population of the refugee camp was targeted whether or not they were combatants. Half of the 13,000 residents were children or elders. The airstrikes called in on the densely populated neighborhoods leveled houses. Bulldozers leveled the remaining residential areas while whole families were inside their homes. The water distribution system and electric power lines were destroyed. And the IDF commanders should study what happened to the Nazi commanders who led the attack on the Warsaw Ghetto. When the war was over, they were tried and convicted and hanged as war criminals. Let the past be a prologue to the future.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenemann
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Netanyahu at Bar-Ilan, affirming the Zionist project, no Palestinian presence in Eretz Yisrael. It'll be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net. We'll be with you next week.